Good evening. My name is Nava Ashraf. I'm professor of economics here at the LSE, and much of my own research actually questions some of the assumptions underlying how we think about human nature within economics, whether it be revealed preference or self-interest as the main driver of economic behavior, and to use those insights to design development programs and policies. So you can imagine that it is my great privilege to have Professor Jeffrey Sachs here with us. And to welcome you all to the third of the Lionel Robbins lectures. And the last two nights have given us so much food for thought in precisely these areas. But before I go on to introduce just slightly more Professor Sachs, I wanted to acknowledge that we are rather privileged tonight. We have the honor of having Sir Lionel Robbins' daughter here with us, Anne Johnson, who's here. So I'd like to welcome you so much. Thank you so much for joining us. So Professor Sachs doesn't need much introduction at all, and I'm going to leave most of the time for him to be able to talk to us. But he holds a university professorship at Columbia University and directs the Earth Institute, from which he has drawn a tremendous amount of attention and resources to the most global, to the most urgent global issues of our time. I'm deeply intrigued that he ended yesterday's lecture with the words that we have it in us to be good, we have it in us to be bad. Tomorrow, I will argue that we have it in us to solve the big problems. So I am sure we're very much looking forward to hearing all about that. And without further ado, Professor Sachs.
Great. Nava, thank you very much, and it's so great to see you here leading this effort on philanthropy also, which is going to make a fantastic contribution. I go to the Vatican quite often, but there are not as many lords at the Vatican as there are lords here. So we have Lord Richard Layard, and we have Lord Nicholas Stern, and we have a wonderful Baroness Molly Meacher also, that's very august company, and I thank you for coming, and thank you again for having me here. In the first lecture, I talked about the idea of economics being, in essence, a healing science, that economics should be a science devoted to the end of, not the conclusion of, but the ends of human well-being. And that we have it within us now to understand in a much deeper way than in the past, though great sages of the past got a lot of it right, what human well-being is constituted of and how it can be promoted. Yesterday, I talked about some of the difficulties. As Darwin said, we carry within us the baggage of our Paleolithic savanna evolution. It's not all to the good. There are parts of our jerry-rigged minds that have evolved that are quite capable of doing terrible things as well as doing very wonderful and heroic things. I strongly side, as I said, with Socrates in believing that by knowing ourselves, by knowing our human nature, we're able to find the way to that pro-social side, which I've equated with morality itself. I've defined morality to be achieving pro-sociality. And that, I think, by understanding where we have weaknesses, where we need to bolster our tendencies, our instincts, our human nature itself, can help us to get to the kind of world that we want to get to. Tonight I'm going to talk about this in practical, though big think terms, because I'm going to talk about the big global problems that we face, the kinds of problems that both Richard Layard and Nick Stern have done so much to help advance on solutions. And I am going to talk about how we can cultivate the understanding, the knowledge, and the virtues in order to solve these problems. As you'll see, this is really directed at the young people here, because like a tough final exam, we're leaving you with a messed up world. We're not leaving you with simple problems. So in this sense, pay attention. You've got homework ahead. But I'm going to argue that this is solvable. So I want to talk about globalization and the challenges of our era of globalization. And to do that, I want to talk about the meaning of globalization itself. And start with the era of modern globalization, which I take to be 5 centuries ago. I'll start with one of the favorite philosophers that we've referred to frequently with Adam Smith in one of my favorite passages of The Wealth of Nations, because I think it displays the humanism, the drive to well-being that absolutely characterizes the Scottish Enlightenment. So globalization has several phases. I want to start back at the beginning of modern globalization when the world truly became connected. The old world's been connected for a long time, but because of the nature of the migration from Asia to the Americas about 15,000 years ago, and then the warming of the Holocene, the land passage from Asia to the Americas was submerged, and the Americas were isolated from the old world from around 12,000 before the present to 1492. Not quite. There was one evident passage of the Vikings to Newfoundland, but it didn't establish a settlement. That was in the era of great advertising when, to attract the Vikings on these voyages, they called what should have been called Iceland Greenland and encouraged Vikings to come settle in the not-so-green Greenland. And then from there, there was evidently some very short passages to northeastern Canada. But aside from that, there was not real contact between the indigenous populations of the Americas and the old world populations for thousands of years, as far as we know, at least not in the Northern Hemisphere. And this globalization occurred at the end of the 15th century. And Adam Smith had some very wise words to say about this, and I'll read at length because I think they're very important for our understanding. He said that the discovery of America and that of a passage to the East Indies by the Cape of Good Hope are the two greatest and most important events recorded in the history of mankind. I think that's a very strong statement by a very shrewd observer, that Columbus's voyage and Da Gama's voyage were the two most important events in the history of mankind. Their consequences have already been very great. That's from 1492 to 1776 when this passage was published. But in the short period of between 2 and 3 centuries, which has elapsed since these discoveries were made, it is impossible that the whole extent of their consequences can have been seen. What benefits or what misfortunes to mankind may hereafter result from those great events, no human wisdom can foresee. By uniting, in some measure, the most distant parts of the world, by enabling them to relieve one another's wants, to increase one another's enjoyments, and to encourage one another's industry, their general tendency would seem to be beneficial. By the way, don't you wish you could write like that? Unbelievable. So, he goes on, though, to the natives, however, both of the East and West Indies, all of the commercial benefits which can have resulted from those events have been sunk and lost in the dreadful misfortunes which they have occasioned. That is to the natives that were receiving the European discoverers and then conquerors. These misfortunes, however, seem to have arisen rather from accident than from anything in the nature of those events themselves. at the particular time when these discoveries were made, the superiority of force happened to be so great on the side of the Europeans that they were enabled to commit with impunity every sort of injustice in those remote countries. Hereafter, perhaps, the natives of those countries may grow stronger, or those of Europe may grow weaker, and the inhabitants of all the different quarters of the world may arrive at that equality of courage and force, which, by inspiring mutual fear, can alone overawe the injustice of independent nations into some sort of respect for the rights of one another. But nothing seems more likely to establish this equality of force than that mutual communication of knowledge and of all sorts of improvements which an extensive commerce from all countries to all countries naturally, or rather necessarily, carries along with it. So what is Smith saying? These discoveries occur, they should be beneficial because international trade enables different parts of the world to satisfy the wants of other countries to mutual gain. But as it happens, the native inhabitants of the East and West Indies suffer miserable catastrophes. He says that's not intrinsic to globalization. An economist would say that, right? So he said that's not intrinsic to these events themselves, but it was because of the accident that Europeans were more powerful, that they could act with impunity and impose every kind of injustice. But then Smith goes on in this marvelously humanistic way, because you might think that a proud British subject would say how wonderful these conquests were and how Britain is extending its reach to the world, but he says, no, this imbalance of force, this injustice, can be rectified. His theory of rectification we would now call realist international relations, that the power balance will change, that the native inhabitants will gain enough power to establish an equality of force and create a balance in which justice can prevail. And he incredibly wisely says, how will that come about? That will come about through trade itself, because it is the communication of knowledge that trade brings along with it that will cause the diffusion of knowledge, capacity, power, that eventually will even out the balance. And that's the world that he looks forward to. To my mind, it's a remarkable passage in every regard in his recognition of the fundamental importance of globalization, in his acknowledgement of the fundamental inequality of result, and in his humanism to say, this is not right, but what we need is eventually a balancing of force so that all parts of the world can benefit, and that that itself will come about through the processes of globalization. I think he got it right, as I'm going to argue, though with a long history that is needed to understand these events. The first globalization from 1500 to 1800, which is sometimes called the Age of Global Commerce or in the early period the Age of Discovery, was a period in which the European countries got imperial footholds, in some places more than footholds. They conquered large areas, and they established global capitalism that was truly global in reach. And global capitalism was both remarkable for its audacity, for its ambition, for its scale, and for its cruelty and violence. Because we really learn from this period that people will do anything. They will murder, they will enslave on a large scale. And capitalism was born in with slavery. And capitalism at a global scale was deeply engaged with slave trade, with forced labor, and with creating global supply chains basically of lots of addictive products. This is the secret of capitalism. Get us addicted, whether it's to sugar or to tobacco or to my favorite addiction, which is coffee. So anytime you want to meet at a coffee shop, I'm game. This created these global supply chains. Millions of Africans were enslaved and brought to the West Indies in particular. The richest part of the empire was the Caribbean. Of course, there were always the dreams and a little bit of reality of gold. The one thing that Adam Smith got analytically wrong was that the Europeans conquered not only by force, though they were pretty good at the gunpowder that they had taken as a technology from China, but they also conquered by microbes. So the other thing that the Europeans brought with them were the old world pathogens that were unknown to the populations of the New World. And this led to a mass die-off of populations due to epidemics of smallpox, syphilis, and many other pathogens that were old world pathogens, where there was either childhood immunity, so the adults came immune but could spread the disease to the native populations. And that's how Cortez, of course, famously conquered with a few troops the Aztec Empire of Central Mexico. Now, that did not establish yet a European dominance in the world. One of the facts of history, one of the hinge points of all of history, which we now understand much better, is that China could have competed and outcompeted the European powers on technological grounds, on navigation, and so forth. But China, for a number of reasons still debated, but probably because of the internal security problems with the nomadic invaders from the north of China, had decided to scrap its naval fleet and its expedition around 1433, the last of the great expeditions of Admiral Zheng He. And after that, the Europeans had the access to open seas. They brought the pathogens. They brought the muskets with them. They brought unbelievable cruelty along with their Bibles. They ended up creating footholds of power all through the world. But that's not really enough to understand why the globalization turned out the way that it did, with the North Atlantic being so predominant and with this country, with Britain being the most powerful country in the world in all of world history up until the middle of the 20th century. And for that, I think there is one overwhelming explanation myself, and that's that. And that is the steam engine, because the next phase of globalization is not the commercial phase. The commercial phase brought us smoking, and it brought us sugar, and it brought us coffee, but it did not bring industrial predominance. And in fact, industry was still a very tiny part of even Britain and the Netherlands, the two most advanced economies of the world, in the middle of the 18th century. What made possible industrialization, of course, was the ability for the first time to break out of what Wrigley, the great economic historian of the Industrial Revolution, calls the organic economy. And Wrigley's point, I think, is decisively correct, which is that as long as humanity depended on the energy that could be mobilized by animal traction, by a bit of wind power, by some water mills on rivers, by wind and sails, we were pretty much limited in the economic potential. There could be relatively richer and poorer countries, but you could not have industrialization or mass urbanization except in tiny pockets. What made the breakthrough to the modern world was the mass mobilization of energy, and that was the genius of Newcomen in 1712 and James Watt, whose steam engine, interestingly, was one of the main patents, was 1776, the very same year as a publication of The Wealth of Nations. You probably know that there was a third important thing in 1776, and that was the publication of Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Other than that, it was a relatively quiet year. There was one philosopher who wrote about pursuing happiness that year also, so happiness studies got a big boost. So it was an interesting year. But this changed history absolutely, fundamentally. And the best evidence of it, I think, is the wonderful pictures that emerge from Angus Maddison's great compilation of macro data extending from 1 AD to the 21st century. And as best as Maddison could produce estimates, this is more or less what gross world product this is gross world product per person in this graph. This is what it looks like. Essentially, not much happens for a long time, for about 1,800 years from 1 AD to the take-up of the steam engine and the beginning of industrialization. And Britain had, we won't go into all of the reasons, but it had a lot of unique features that made Britain the right place at the right time for all of the parts to come together to enable this unique breakthrough. I regard it something like the beginning of life, where you have lots of organic compounds floating around in the soup, and you have lipid bilayers, and they circle around some other molecules, and suddenly with some energy input, you start getting an autopoietic process of self-generation. That's what modern economic growth is like. It's extraordinarily rare. You had to be able to have an energy source, but you had to be able to mine for it. You had to have it available. It had to be accessible. You had to be smart enough to do it. You had to have a University of Glasgow to do it. And you had to have patents because they were just insanely out for profits to do this. So there was a little bit of everything. No matter which department you're in, you could say, I understand the Industrial Revolution. If you're an economist, it's patent rights. And if you're a technologist, it's Watt. And if you're into science, you would say everything in the modern world was inspired by Newton, which I think is basically true also. And all of these pieces came together, but there was one more thing in England, and that was easily accessible coal. Because all the rest, without that, it's completely impossible. And there are not too many places that could have put all the pieces together, but you did have essentially a cell that started and was able to reproduce and was able to generate self-sustaining economic growth. And we know, without belaboring the history of modern economic growth, which starts around, Madison dated it to at the period just after the Napoleonic Wars, when there's a big take-up of the new technologies, of course, metallurgy as well, mechanization of looms and of spinning in the textile sector, putting a steam engine on a cart on rails and inventing railway, putting a steam engine on a boat and inventing ocean steamers and all the rest. The era of modern economic growth takes off, and again, these are the Madison data. A couple places in the world really take off. The Atlantic region, basically. This is what Madison calls the Western offshoots, which is the sum of the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand. So this is the U.S., basically, from a arithmetic point of view. And this is Western Europe. And these two places take off. and the rest of the world, not too much happens in industrialization for a very long period of time. And good development economics and good economic history needs to explain the diffusion of technology and the reasons why technology does or does not spread and the nature of that dissemination. Why is it that Africa and Asia do not industrialize, with the exception of Japan at the after the Meiji Restoration of 1868, but China does not, and Africa remains impoverished all the way to the end of the line, basically. These are the topics of economic development. There's a lot to say about them. We know that part of the answer is political economy. Part of the answer, I believe, is resource base and physical geography and proximity and many other factors. But what the most basic point to emphasize is that this phase of globalization is the age of divergence. The North Atlantic comes to utterly dominate the world economy and geopolitics, and the rest of the world lags very far behind. And the result of that is that the North Atlantic kicks the butt of the rest of the world. And I don't mean that in the football rankings. I mean in the nastiness, because this is also the age of modern imperialism. So the opening of the gap of income is also the opening of an unbelievable divergence of power. And as of 1800, of course, the Spanish and the Portuguese had settled South America. They had settled parts of, well, all of Central America and Mexico. We don't like to remind Mexico that it used to go up to there, because somehow they made a mistake. But in any event, France had the Louisiana Territories, and Britain had its empire east of the Mississippi. And, of course, there were then pockets of settlement, the East India Company and various ports of call, Singapore, settled by Raffles, Hong Kong, and the beginnings of colonialism. Notice, by the way, that while the Americas were fully colonized, Africa was almost not at all colonized except for the ports. And Africa's colonization awaited one other great invention, of course, and that was gin and tonic. Because until there was gin and tonic, it was deathly to go into Africa because of malaria. The tonic, remember, is quinine. And that is both prophylactic and curative of malaria. Britain discovered this from the native knowledge in Peru, because its quinine is a derivative of the cinchona tree bark. And then the seeds were duly stolen to bring for multiplication. And then gin and tonic became the choice of colonial rule. And by 1914, every piece of Africa was colonized, because it was safe to sit on the veranda, sipping your drink in the evening, and dominating all of Africa. All of this happened within a few years in the 1880s. The power imbalance was already there. The quinine was needed, and then you needed one very polite conference, the Congress of Berlin, in 1884, because it was very important that the Europeans should be very polite as they divided up Africa. And so Germany, France, England had to do it in an extremely civilized way. No Africans attending, of course. But Africa was fully divided up. And by 1914, this was truly the Western world as it looked. And this was the world, really, that Britain made, because Britain was the world's leading economy, it was the world's leading power, it was the world's leading navy. It had everything in its hand. The United States was so far behind because first U.S. had to subjugate its own native populations. That took the whole 19th century, so it took a long time to basically create several genocides in the western United States and the native populations. And then as soon as all the genocides were completed or all of the forced expulsions, then in 1898 they said, now it's our turn for empire. But Africa was already taken. Almost everything was taken, and Latin America was already financially under British control, but because of, in foreign policy terms, the United States claimed effective suzerainty over South America. So we beat up Cuba and Puerto Rico and the Philippines. That was America's little empire at the time. But America was watching its eye for the next moment to come to this. So I think it's very important for us to understand both the amazing dynamism of capitalism and also the unbelievable cruelty of capitalism, and the fact that all through the history of capitalism, from the first days, despite Adam Smith's statements, despite Milton Friedman's Free to Choose, despite Nozick's ideas of libertarian societies, capitalism has been a story of power and of greed merged together, promoting a phenomenal advance of technology. This has created a world of unprecedented wealth. Well, Britain was pretty good. I can't vouch for every shaded country in this, but this is a book that was published a few years ago I can't believe you guys didn't reach Chad. But in any event, you see, being landlocked has its certain advantages. You remain impoverished, but no one wants to come invade you. So there are a few places in Central Africa, in Mongolia, we have in Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, that were not invaded by Britain. But basically, Britain really ran the show, and pretty impressive. Now, we know there is then a third phase, and then finally I will get to today. The third phase of capitalism, I believe, begins at the end of the Second World War. The period from 1914, the map I showed you, to 1945 was the period of European barbarism and self-destruction. Never in history, I think, and certainly in centuries, had there been anything like the violence, the destruction, the cruelty, the stupidity that engulfed Europe from 1914 to 1945. Two civil wars with the Great Depression in between. Absolute catastrophe and interestingly, if you could use that term, for no reason. World War I is certainly the stupidest war in all of history. It's just impossible to understand why it happened. It was the apex of technological know-how. It was a glorious period, especially in Europe, for the advancement of life. Keynes, in some of the most beautiful writing in economics, waxes rhapsodic in the economic consequences of the peace, which he wrote in 1919, about those days before the war where you could sit in bed and call your broker to order bonds that would convey money to any part of the world so you could invest in any part of the world from your bedside with your phone and with this wonderful globalization, and where you could travel to any part of the world and have your passport recognized. He made generalizations that were perhaps special for his class, but this was an impressive time, and yet we ended up in complete disaster. And I would say I've read probably 30 or 40 books about World War I. Nobody has a real theory. The best you have is a kind of TikTok explanation. You can say who sent what memo on what day, who wanted this, who wants that, but to see the end of civilization in this way, the destruction of a generation, the prelude to Hitler, there was no deep reason at all. And I emphasize this always because it comes to our talk yesterday. We're really capable of profound stupidity. Never forget it, because a main part of our job is to try to prevent that stupidity. And so whenever in doubt, be nice. Honestly, it's not a joke. It's absolutely true, because one damn thing can lead to another, and before you know it, you've destroyed a society. You've had tens of millions of people dead. And that's from a kind of casualness of walking off to war for what was to be 30 days in August 1914. Well, by 1945, the world was quite different. Churchill called on the United States for the new world to come save the old world. Fortunately, there was a great leader in the United States, Franklin Roosevelt. He was also a very wily leader. So he said, "We will lend you everything you need, and we will bankrupt you along the way." That was the U.S. strategy. So the U.S. strategy was, we will save the old world, but we will be the new world. We will be the new power after World War II. And as much as John Maynard Keynes tried to design an international monetary fund that would favor the debtor, the U.S. was having none of it. The IMF would favor the creditor, thank you. And that's pretty normal in history, that the creditor gets to call the shots. And the U.S. idea was, we will squeeze Britain and France enough that the empires will be disgorged, that Western Europe will become free, prosperous again, democratic. But if there's going to be an empire, it's going to be our empire, thank you. It's not going to be your empire anymore. Of course, the United States can't imagine itself as an imperial power, so the mode of empire of the United States is local rule. It's not direct conquest. But the U.S. created a secret army in 1947 called the CIA. It's not so secret, but it is the president's private army, and it is allowed to go overthrow governments to make sure that the imperial power is preserved. And the CIA has overthrown dozens and dozens of governments around the world to make sure that in this local rule setting, that the local rulers are to the likes of the United States. Now, the post-colonial period, though, was better for the rest of the world than the true colonial era, because I will give the United States one positive mark in this, even though there's a lot of stupidity and cruelty, and that is that the United States fostered a trading system and sovereignty within the United Nations in a way that enabled the post-colonial countries to begin to catch up. My own view is that colonized countries could not develop in the 19th century or the early 20th century, mainly because the colonial powers did not want to educate local populations. So the most important single factor of development is human capital. And while there were cadres that were trained in the colonial possessions, there was not mass education of society because that would undermine the political control of those countries. And so I think that colonization really meant the absence of early industrialization. And it was only after World War II and the end of the formal European imperial structures that the diffusion of technology along the lines that Adam Smith talked about was able to really do its job. Starting in the 1950s, we see a change, a fundamental change in global growth. And that is we begin an era of catching up, or the term we use, an era of convergence. So starting in the 1950s, and by no means uniformly, the laggard countries start to achieve economic growth faster than the advanced economies of Western Europe and the United States. And that process has been underway for about 70 years now. And that's extremely important to understand the world we're in. It's exactly the mechanism that Smith talked about, that open trade would enable the flow of knowledge to thereby enable the growth of the economies. And, of course, growth dynamics depend, again, on many things. They depend on investment, most importantly, and now we understand better than before that that's investment in people, in health and education, as well as investment in infrastructure, which is largely a government function, as well as investment in business capital. And until the end of the imperial age, that triple investment package was not really possible, and I think that's the main reason why the era of divergence was as divergent as it was. It was, in a way, an artifact of the colonial period. It was an extension of the observation that Smith made in the phase up to 1776. Lots of good things have happened during this period, by the way. The period from the 1950s has been a period of worldwide economic growth and a sharp decline of poverty. And this is the World Bank's estimates of trends in what the World Bank calls extreme poverty or absolute poverty. It uses a purchasing power adjusted line. It used to be a dollar a day at international prices, then it was turned into a dollar 25 a day, and now it's a dollar 90 a day in 2011 international prices. But the idea is comparability over time, and the estimate is that even in the period from 1990 to 2015, the poverty rate fell from around 37% of the world population to around 9.6% of the world population. This is a phenomenal achievement. And it's a phenomenal gain of human well-being also. Without question, it's associated with growing longevity, more healthy life years, a sharp decline of the rate of hunger, and many, many other benefits. Of course, still, as of now, there are lots of poor people. And that is, from a moral point of view, I think even more poignant in the rich world that we have. The World Bank says 700 million, other estimates say a billion people living in extreme poverty, maybe a seventh, an eighth, a tenth of the world population. Small enough share to say, let's end it, but not a small enough share to say it's been ended. There's a lot of suffering associated with that. Professor Helliwell and Professor Layard and I use the index of the Gallup surveys, the so-called ladder index or Cantrell ladder that measures subjective well-being or quality of life to assess differences of self-reported or subjective life quality around the world. And this is a map of some of the more recent data. The new report comes out on March 20. And what you can see is that there still are places where the happiness scores are on a scale from 0 to 10 still very low, places that have a lot of poverty or a lot of disruption. The rich parts of the world and the happy but not so rich Latin America and Western Europe tend to score highest on these rankings. The United States, by the way, if you look in detail, which is obscured by this color coding, comes in now around 20th. I won't give the precise ranking for the 2015 data, but it's around 20th in the world. Even though it's much richer than that, it's not so happy for some of the social reasons that I've talked about and I'll talk about again. I want to show this map to emphasize that while the world's made a lot of progress in economic development and a sharp reduction of poverty, it's quite evident that from a moral point of view, there's a lot more progress in quality of life that can be achieved. And one of the aims of our work, and especially the statistical work that John Helliwell pioneers, is to understand what are the drivers of change of subjective well-being. Income per capita is an important one. Health, measured as healthy life years, which is correlated also with the income per capita, is another independent important variable. But then to our measures of social well-being, perceptions of corruption, and the other factors that I talked about at the very conclusion of the first lecture. Well, the world also not only grew, but either grew more unequal or in many places remained highly unequal. So this is the Gini coefficient, a worldwide comparison. Of course, it's a variable between full equality at a value of zero and full inequality of income, a value of one. That means one person has everything and everyone else has nothing, gives a Gini of one. And it's quite interesting. The Americas are all unequal, with the exception of Canada. And the reason, essentially, is that these are conquest societies that brought in large slave populations, that dominated indigenous populations, and that created highly stratified societies by race. And that legacy continues until today. Many African countries are highly unequal, especially if there are large resource deposits so that the rents can be taken by small parts of the population. And my favorite countries in the north, the Scandinavian social democracies are by far the most equal societies in the world. This is important because it's highly correlated with determinants of well-being, especially social capital. And the United States, sadly, has gotten tremendously more unequal during the last 36 years. I date it from January 20, 1981. That's the day that Ronald Reagan became president and proceeded to wreck the American Republic for the next 36 years. China also has become much more unequal during its period of rapid growth, whether that's a phase of the so-called Kuznets curve that you become more unequal and then more equal later, or whether it's a sign of chronic inequality, which I tend to believe, China has become a much less equal society as well. Well, the U.S. Learned a lot from Britain, the U.S. empire is slightly different from how Britain directly controlled territory, but there's never been in the history of the world a projection of power like the U.S., and the U.S. Was the follower the good student of Britain. So hooray for the English-speaking peoples, definitely the most violent in modern history, unfortunately, with the greatest reach of power The U.S. has military bases in 70 countries. It has a massive empire. It undermines governments relentlessly. It's not a surprise to me why we've got problems. But our self-understanding of these issues is nearly non-existent. If you say America has an empire in America, you're viewed as a kook. You're not viewed as a serious student or serious observer. You've just read too much Chomsky. Chomsky is absolutely our most brilliant expositor of public affairs in the United States. And it's not surprising because he's our most brilliant linguist, and so he really makes words come to life and understands what they mean. This is, again, to emphasize that power and corruption and abuse go together. And so the hardest work that the United States certainly has to do is to heal itself internally. We're doing it by having the scariest show we can have until we're shocked into reality. So we're taking one more fling with surrealism, and then we're going to get serious and be nice again. Now, let me turn to the fourth phase of globalization. That's your phase. That's the new phase that we're living in. And I mean this to be the period from now into the 21st century, because it poses unique challenges and moral challenges. I think there are four very important trends that we have. First is the end of the North Atlantic Age, which you could date from 1500 at its beginning. You could more realistically date, say, from 1850, the age of high imperialism and European industrialization. But for the first time in hundreds of years, the North Atlantic, in relative terms, is being eclipsed, and especially by Asia, and especially by East Asia. And that's a huge transformation. And it's something that I think defines our modern politics. There's also tremendous demographic change underway, which I'll show you in a moment. A third fundamental forcing, which is unique to our time, is the environmental crisis. So humanity and environment is a story that goes back to the beginnings of at least the Neolithic period. And Herodotus wrote extensively about deforestation in Attica and in other parts of Greece. But for the first time in history, we have the great capacity to wreck the whole planet, not just our local nest. And that is a defining aspect of our need, and therefore also a defining aspect of moral thinking, because at the core of this is the public good of conserving biodiversity and conserving the climate system and conserving our capacity to thrive. And the fourth dimension of this that is enormously important is that we have our own technological revolution underway. Ours is the digital revolution. I think it's true that every generation since Watt had its revolution, its technological revolution. Probably everyone seemed as amazing as the others. I don't know whether ours is more amazing or less amazing, but I think it is roughly comparable. What the information revolution will make possible in our economic life, in my view, is fundamentally transformative and fundamentally positive as well, potentially. But like all technologies that we have developed, they can be used for good or bad. And so it's what Ed Wilson said that I quoted several times already, that we have stumbled into the 21st century with our Stone Age emotions, our medieval institutions, and our godlike technologies. And that is true for us again today. So what does this mean? Well, one striking fact is that Northeast Asia, which is China, Japan, Korea, is now much larger in economic size than the European Union or the United States. These are the estimates by the IMF of the share of world output of these three big regions. This is the first time in centuries that you have a region that's not a North Atlantic region as one of the world's centers of economic life. And I put China, Japan, and Korea together because it's basically and increasingly an integrated economy. It's a little bit masked by geopolitics right now because the United States' strategy is to keep Japan and Korea on our side. And this is one of the dumb ideas of Trump. It's a long list, but it's one of them, that we're going to have a war with China. And his craziest advisor, Bannon, apparently believes it's going to be a hot war. His incompetent advisor, Navarro, thinks it's going to be a trade war. But whichever it is, they're both idiotic ideas, although Bannon is really mad. No, Navarro is just a bad economist, which is forgiven. But this is unbelievable. From 1990, East Asia was about 6% of the world economy. Now it's something like 23%. Of world output. And the U.S., which at the end of World War II was probably at that moment maybe 40%, and by 1950, 27%, according to Madison, of the world economy, has now come down, and we're at about 15%. And this is, by the way, why the United States is so neurotic right now also. We're having a testosterone moment, like I described yesterday. We're losing the competition. The testosterone is down. We had to get a guy with hypertestosterone and sociopathy in office. But it's not going to work because these are fundamental economic patterns. And they're fundamental, most importantly, there are just a lot more people in China. Unless China's really poor per capita, it's going to be really bigger in economic terms because the population is four times the American population. And these are aggregates, not per person differences. To show you from a 600-year perspective, 500 years of history and 100 years of projection according to a standard model of convergence, China and India, well, they were the dominant economies of the world up until around 1800. Western Europe is this graph, and it did something like this. It had a great industrialization, had a wonderful empire. It broke itself to pieces in the first half of the 20th century. And then up until today, it's declined to around 17% of world output. And because Europe has a shrinking aggregate population, its share of world output will probably continue to decline to below 10% by the end of the 21st century. The United States, not very many people, not much until the U.S. surge of industrialization. Then it was America's turn, and now America is facing the same decline, and probably that decline will continue. Asia, or China, which is this curve, very important to understand. Things were okay when Adam Smith wrote about China in 1776. He said it had reached a very high level of affluence, but it had reached the limits of its constitution, is the way he put it, because he said China is bound by stagnation because it's a closed society. Another unbelievable observation by just an unbelievably classy observer. He got that right, but of course it was worse than stagnation. China was basically rather brutalized. The war between Britain and China, 1839 to 1842, I class as the most astounding war in modern history. It was the war, of course, to ensure that China opened up trade to opium. And it was like being attacked by Colombia in the United States to make sure the cocaine could come in freely. So the opium wars were part of the destruction. And then basically it was one damn thing after another for China for a long time. It was the opium wars. It was the extraterritorial power. It was the Boxer Rebellion. It was the whole mess. So that by 1950, China was about 5% of the world population. Since the People's Republic was established, China has soared, but China's population is actually going to go down in the second half of the 21st century as the one-child policy fully rolls out. And so China's going to end up also at around 10% of world output. And finally, there's Africa. Africa went down, down, down because it didn't achieve economic growth. But now Africa is both achieving economic growth and an absolute surge of population. I like the looks of this picture, by the way, because it says that in the 21st century, we'll have a kind of convergence and we'll have different regions of the world, each having their respective shares, and nobody has to dominate anybody else. This is a time when we could really have that balance that enables all of us to benefit from each other, without the presumption that it's the American century or the China century. And fortunately, it won't be the China century either. I don't want the China century. I don't want the America century. China's getting really old. And one good thing is that old countries don't generally go to war so often. It's a young man's sport, according to Richard Wrangham. I think that this is actually a rather heartening view. One thing on population that I want to point out here, Europe is, where's Europe, the blue line. This is Europe's share of the world population. You see what the low population growth means for Europe. What's astounding in our time is Africa, which is this share. Africa was around 10% of the world population, as best as Madison can estimated up to the colonial period, then it declined significantly. But Africa is now on an extraordinary demographic increase, too fast, in my view, for its own good and for ecological sustainability of a very fragile continent, very susceptible to global climate change. But on the mainstream estimates, Africa will reach about a third of the world population, almost 4 billion people by the end of the 21st century. I don't think it's quite going to happen, but I'm just reporting the mainstream UN medium forecast. And one thing that I do think is important about this, and I know time is short, but I will try to conclude. If you want to understand the migration anxieties and understand Brexit and understand the politics, it's important to keep this graph in mind as well, because part of the demographic change is that Europe, back in 1950, and this is Europe including Eastern Europe and Russia, if you take all of Europe, it was twice the combined population of the Middle East and Africa. So Europe in 1950, even though it was with its back on the floor because of the disastrous 30 years of civil war, had twice the population of all of Africa and all of the Middle East. The idea that the neighborhood was a danger was not in anybody's mind. Fast forward now to today. Now Africa has a population of 1 billion people. The Middle East of about 500 million people. Europe combined around 700 million people. Now Europe is surrounded by a neighborhood that is twice the population of Europe. So from being twice as large as the neighborhood to half as large as the neighborhood. And if you're thinking in us versus them approach, Europe feels surrounded. And it feels that the migration pressures are enormous, which they are, and perhaps unstoppable. And so this, I think, is the deep part of what is happening. But there's a lot more to come, because Europe's population is projected basically to decline gradually, but Africa's population is projected to quadruple in the 21st century. And so if you look at Europe versus Africa plus the Middle East, the neighborhood, if you could put it that way, from Europe's point of view, will be 10 times the population of Europe. And so this is where a lot of the deep anxieties are coming from. My own view, without having the time to go into length, is that we should be aiming for Africa's well-being first and foremost, for this curve to turn something like that. And the way that that would happen is one overwhelming basic good idea, which is keep kids in school, and the fertility transition will drop the total fertility rate from around 5, which it is today, to a little over 2, probably within a generation. And then this curve would be Africa population perhaps peaking at around 2 or 2.5 billion rather than at 4 billion. But this is a second driver to keep in mind of why we face these pressures and tensions. Now, let me turn to a piece of good news, and that is that our capacity to address every manner of economic challenge, whether it is education or whether it is healthcare or whether it is efficient production or whether it is the ability to let our machines do the work while we go off to satisfy our coffee addiction, which is my dream, is better than ever. And that is fundamentally because of the digital revolution and the single shorthand of the digital revolution, though not the true shorthand, is Moore's Law. The fact that the transistor count on integrated circuits has been doubling every 18 to 24 months since the first integrated circuit was etched back in the end of the 1950s. And this means that a microprocessor now has more than 5 billion transistors on it. But if you add in all sorts of improved design of parallel processing and many other things, it's much more than Moore's Law right now. Our capacity to compute is absolutely so phenomenal that the machines really can solve problems that were unsolvable before. And that gives us the chance to solve some very, very big problems. One thing to note, all of that innovation is taking place basically in 3.5 regions of the world. You could say the U.S., Western Europe, and Northeast Asia. These are the patent bubbles of these three regions. This is where the overwhelming endogenous growth phenomenon is occurring, almost not at all elsewhere. But the technology is still diffusing everywhere. I say 3.5 because there's Silicon Valley, and then there's Kendall Square in Cambridge. And even in New York, we have some nice innovation going on. But that's a map of where this pump of digital revolution is taking place. Okay, I can't stay on good news for more than 2 minutes. So one more piece of bad news, which was the last mega trend that is important for our consideration, and that is that inadvertently, because it isn't advertently except for a very few people, inadvertently we're wrecking the planet through this process of 200 years of modern economic growth. It started with Watt. In a way, you gotta love coal, because without coal, there would be no modern economy. We would have a life expectancy half of what we have. We would be living in poverty. We would be talking about the latest famine, because it was fossil fuel that brought us to where we are. And there's nothing wrong with coal, oil, and gas, except that it can destroy everything, we discovered. We discovered that. We didn't discover that, but the scientists discovered that step by step between the 1820s and the 1890s. Obviously, those findings didn't get into Trump's primary education, which must have been sometime in the 18th century. We knew already by 1896, when Svante Arrhenius, the Nobel Swedish chemist, made the calculations by hand of what a doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere would mean for global warming and almost nailed it, we knew that there was an anthropogenic driver of climate change. Arrhenius made one erroneous mistake that was quite serious, and he said it would take 750 years to double the CO2. And that's because he was a better chemist than an economic forecaster, and he didn't see what China was going to do. And Napoleon had warned, when China opens its eyes, the world will shake. And China became such a large emitter, and the rise of the world economy became so great that what was expected by Arrhenius to take 750 years will happen by 2050. We will double the CO2 in the atmosphere. Nick Stern has done more than anybody else in the world to point out, the dangers of this are absolutely profound, and they could be devastating. The fact that coal does this is not by itself a moral question about the morality of coal. It is a quantum physical property of CO2 that it absorbs infrared radiation. It's just bad luck. It just happens that because the three molecules vibrate in a certain way, they absorb the infrared that Earth radiates and otherwise would send into space, and that traps the heat. And that does pose a moral question, because now we do know that we will wreck the planet unless we change the energy system. And that becomes a moral question, not just a physical chemistry question. We've had 3 years of the warmest economy in the warmest world in the last 3 years, each year breaking the record of the past. 2016 was 1.22 degrees C warmer on average than the level from around 1880 to 1910, the so-called pre-industrial level. That means we're much farther than halfway to 2 degrees, and much, much farther to the ill-defined well under 2 degrees that is the Paris climate target for limiting global warming. Part of that warming last year was an El Nino, so the underlying smoothed estimate is that we're about 1.07 degrees C higher than the pre-industrial level. But we're going to be at a 2-degree threshold or a 2.5 or 3-degree threshold before we can blink an eye, unless we decide that one of the greatest challenges that we face as a civilization on a world scale is to decarbonize the energy system. And for all the reasons I've been arguing, that is a fundamental question of human well-being, and so it's fundamentally a moral question, though it helps if you know a little bit of science too. This becomes a great challenge. The famous conclusion of the IPCC is we have to go to zero net carbon emissions to have a fighting chance, and by around 2070, to have a fighting chance of staying below 2 degrees C, a two-thirds chance. And if we want a likely chance of well below 2 degrees, say 1.8 degrees C, probably by around 2050. We have to bend a rising emissions curve down to complete decarbonization within the next 30 years. And we have to do it with one arm tied behind our back by Donald Trump, because he's going to do everything he can to maximize emissions in the next few years. And our job is to say, you're an idiot, because we're not going to let the world be ruined by such a corrupt ignoramus. And that's really true. We have to discredit these horrible tendencies, which are basically tendencies of corruption more than anything else, because they're tendencies of the oil industry with which he has surrounded himself and actually handed the whole State Department over to Mr. Tillerson from ExxonMobil. You could not make this stuff up, actually. If you really want to handle climate change, would you give the State Department to ExxonMobil? I wouldn't advise it. So we need a moral breakthrough. And Pope Francis is our greatest moral leader of our time. He reaches more people in moral reasoning than anybody on the planet. And he issued a remarkable encyclical, which I think we can recommend for a science class, a theology class, and a public policy class, all with high confidence about the challenge that we face of making the world fair and environmentally sustainable. And what was powerful in his call was he called on the world to make a plan. He said interdependence obliges us to think of one world with a common plan. Yet the same ingenuity which has brought about enormous technological progress has so far proved incapable of finding effective ways of dealing with grave environmental and social problems worldwide. He came to the UN on September 25th, 2015, and spoke to world leaders about the need for a plan, and that was the prelude to the adoption that day of the Sustainable Development Goals. And these are the 17 globally agreed guideposts for decency. Sustainable development in the UN framework means economic progress, which is very important for well-being, combined with social inclusion or justice, including gender equality, narrowing income inequalities, peaceful societies, combined with environmental sustainability. This is as close as we can come to a diplomatic roadmap for an ethical approach for the planet. It's very hard to get the world to agree on anything. But governments worked for 3 years to negotiate these goals. And I say to the young people here, these are the only goals the world will agree on in this direction during your young adulthood. Use them. Make them real. Make them alive. There's no fallback. It took 3 years to get them. They're pretty damn good. Make sure you know them. Go quiz your sibs, your friends, your colleagues. Make sure they know what SDG 9 is, infrastructure, SDG 13, climate change, SDG 4, education, so that they know what this is and that they know what the goals are. Because we need to make these real now. So I want to close with an analogy. First, actually, I want to point out one more important moral point. First, an economic point. If you try to estimate the costs of achieving these goals, I can't come up with a number more than 4% of annual output invested in targeted ways as necessary to achieve all of these goals, ending poverty, ending hunger, getting every child in school, getting everybody to have access to modern health services, everybody with safe water and sanitation, and decarbonization of the energy system. It just doesn't cost very much. It's a tiny fraction of our income. Of course, our income globally is $125 trillion, so 3% of that is almost $4 trillion a year. It's not a tiny number. But we blow $4 trillion like nothing in Iraq and in Afghanistan. We paid $5 trillion for those two stupid wars. So we're big enough to do this without too much sweat. And what I can tell you, again, in shorthand, is that when we direct resources towards important issues, we can achieve marvelous results. In economics, you sometimes hear from some of my colleagues, though surely not at LSE, oh, you can't direct resources that way. The market has to do it. If you actually give money, it'll be wasted or it'll be stolen or some other fantasy. But often we need to direct resources to important things. And I argued for a long time, based on the wisdom I got from a wonderful professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, Chris Curtis, that you could control malaria. And he told me how it could be done. And I have a loud mouth, so I started complaining about it for many years. And I even said to the Bush administration White House, I'm going to tell you how to have a big success. And it hurts me to do so because you guys don't deserve it. Because it was up until this guy, I hated him the most. And so I said, I don't even like telling you such a good story that for a tiny amount you can save the world. But I have to do it because ethically I have to tell you the truth, that you could save millions of lives. And they did it, actually. And the lives were saved. And George W. Bush said, this is my proudest legacy, which, by the way, makes sense because he wrecked so many things. But we got malaria funding up, and malaria deaths started to come down sharply. And the curve, that's up to 2010, the curve is now somewhere around here. Malaria deaths are down by more than 50%. Don't let anybody ever tell you you can't solve big problems. And don't let anyone tell you money doesn't matter except for rich people. We saw yesterday how greedy rich people are and how they cheat everywhere, whether in the banks or how they roll the dice or how they count numbers or how they flip coins. But one of the things they constantly say, it's not the money, to people who have nothing. So if you want to help people have access to health care or education, it's no disgrace to give them some help. And I haven't noticed that it's a deep disgrace to receive the help if it keeps you alive and gets you health care and education. So that's a point that I really think is quite important. And we need $10 billion a year now. I'm trying to find any of it to end the AIDS epidemic, because the most important way to do it can be done by $10 billion a year. The U.S. military spends $2.5 billion a day. 4 days. I tell them, take a long weekend, and we can end AIDS. This is really what it's about. This is what economics is really about. It's about how we direct resources to human well-being. It's not about market equilibrium. It's about how we use what we have to solve human problems. And there is a principle that I find very powerful of the Catholic Church called the universal destination of goods. Because in Catholic social teaching, markets are fine, property rights are good, but they're not inviolate. Because all goods are to serve ultimately a moral purpose. And Pope Paul VI, in a beautiful encyclical on Populorum Progressio in 1967, said, everyone knows that the fathers of the church laid down the duty of the rich toward the poor in no uncertain terms. As St. Ambrose put it, you are not making a gift of what is yours to the poor man, but you are giving him back what is his. You have been appropriating things that are meant to be for the common use of everyone. The earth belongs to everyone, not to the rich. If you remember one thing from my three lectures, please remember this. Because we have no effective budget constraint to stop massive suffering. We just need to mobilize the resources in a way that can make it work. Now, I want to just conclude with a way that we can do it. When I was 7 years old, President Kennedy was giving this speech. I was actually 6.5 years old. I remember not the speech, but I remember the time well, because President Kennedy was saying, we should go to the moon. And I watched every space shot from Mercury to Gemini to Apollo during my youth. And President Kennedy said something that is absolutely wonderful about mobilizing human activity. I believe this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish. I love that mode of leadership. It's just saying, let's do something. It may be hard. And in this speech, which you can find online, May 25th, 1961, Kennedy goes on for paragraphs more saying, if you don't mean it, don't start. No sense in going halfway. So if you want to do it, we got to invest in it. We've got to really make it done. And of course, 8 years from this speech, Neil Armstrong walked on the moon and returned safely to Earth. Unbelievable achievement. And that's what directing resources towards goals might mean. So in my opinion, sustainable development is our generation, and by that I mean your generation's moonshot. Make it work. It's not impossible. It's not simple to end poverty by 2030, but it can be done. It's not simple to decarbonize the energy system, but it can be done. We can create what I like to call smart, fair, and sustainable economies. Smart using our technologies, fair meaning just, and sustainable meaning environmentally sustainable. Now, we don't have much trust in government. It's collapsing. And this just goes up to last year, so we're now into negative numbers. And that's a big problem because people feel, oh, we can't do anything, we can't do anything. But actually, when we try to do things, we can do marvelous things. We sequenced the human genome. We've explored Mars. The internet is an invention that started with U.S. government support. The first email was the National Science Foundation. The capacity when we try is unlimited. But to try, we have to pass the marshmallow test. You know the marshmallow test. The four-year-old is told, you can have the marshmallow here, but I'm going to step out of the room, says the psychologist. If you wait when I come back in a few minutes, you can have two marshmallows. It's called delayed gratification. Of course, this is our biggest mental challenge right now. The rich just want their tax cuts, and they want them now. And our society is a little bit switched on for no delayed gratification. The New Yorker ran this cartoon a couple of weeks ago. You can eat one marshmallow right now, or if you wait 15 minutes, I'll give you two marshmallows and swear you in as President of the United States. That would have been good for America. He would have eaten the marshmallow, and we would at least have Pence as president. Now, let me encourage you to take this seriously, especially the young people. And I'll make a point about America because we are a kind of lost society for the moment. This is an index by one political historian of swings between the private greed, I would say, and the public good. And the argument is an argument that a late great historian, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., made about 40 years ago, that America goes through waves of private-oriented activity and then public-oriented activity. And he said these waves last around 30 years. My problem was I took him literally, so I knew that when Barack Obama was elected in 2008, we were done with the Reagan era. But it didn't work that way. We continued with tax cuts. We made George Bush's tax cuts permanent. We didn't lay 1 mile of fast rail, didn't build any infrastructure. We remained trapped in a can't-do, government is the enemy, low taxation, low public purpose society. So this was supposed to turn down here. Now you have to win the White House in 2020 and inaugurate the right president in 2021. But don't lose heart because we're in a long period. We had Herbert Hoover, and then we had the New Deal. We had the Great Society and the fight against poverty and the introduction of Medicare and the successes of the moonshot. And then Reagan came in here, and we've been in a wave of conservatism for decades now. But we can get over it. And I'm putting my hope in the millennials the generations to come that you're going to teach, because the millennials are progressive. On average, in the United States, they want a social order that is fair. What this shows is that the younger you are, the more you want government services, the more you want health insurance provided for all. The older you get, the more conservative are the answers. But the good news is it's not just a life course becoming conservative. It's that today's millennials are more progressive than any generation, including my own, of the last 50 years. So I think you can make it. And I will end with the key observation which makes this possible. We have the technology. The economic burden is actually small, so don't think you're heroes if you achieve sustainable development. It means you've shifted a few percent of global income, not more than that. This doesn't require the sacrifice of a generation. It requires some attention. It requires some sense of justice. It requires some decency. It requires some patience. It requires passing the marshmallow test. It requires some technical training. You're going to be the world's authorities because you're being trained at this school. So you're going to be in the position to help guide this effort. But most important, I think, is, as Pope Francis said, it requires a moral vision and it requires decency. And I think the most important thing that it requires is an understanding of the commonalities of humanity and how we truly are all in this together. And Kennedy said something that, to my mind, is his greatest statement. It was given in another great speech in 1963, June 10, 1963, when he had faced near Armageddon in the Cuban Missile Crisis and decided, after the almost destruction of humanity, that he would campaign in 1963 for peace with the Soviet Union. It was an incredible insight. It was a vision of moral reasoning, because he came to understand, first of all, that if he had followed his advisors, the world would have ended, because his advisors all advised to strike, whereas Kennedy decided for patience. He understood, second, that Khrushchev was his partner, because Khrushchev was no doubt surrounded also by crazy advisors. And the two of them together had saved the world. And he and Khrushchev and Pope John Paul XXIII in 1963, and Harold Macmillan, who played an important role as advisor to Kennedy, went on a campaign to turn the Cold War into cooperation. And he gave a speech in 1963, June 10, called the Peace Speech by historians, where he talked about the capacity to make peace. And essentially, the speech is about the prisoner's dilemma and how we don't have to live in the prisoner's dilemma. We can grasp cooperation, he said, and the other side will grasp cooperation too. And he uses the logic that both sides are human and both sides can understand peace. And he said beautiful words that were so beautiful that Nikita Khrushchev, upon hearing them, called the U.S. ambassador, Averill Harriman, who was envoy in Moscow, and said, "I want to make peace with that man." And 5 weeks later, the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was signed. And 3 months after that, Kennedy was dead, possibly at the hands of a right-wing assassin who was perhaps part of a conspiracy in reaction to the peace initiative. But Kennedy had a vision of cooperation, and it was grasped by the other side. It was grasped instinctively. It was literally Khrushchev saying, "I want to make peace with that man." And the words that I find so beautiful are these: "So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Sachs, for that tour de force, throwing down the gauntlet to all of us for the moral challenges and obligations we face today. I have been given a very polite reminder that we have to finish exactly at 8, but they are giving me the signal that we can have 2 questions. So I know so many of you...
I've given lots of reminders, by the way. So I apologize very much to the staff. I really do.
I'm going to take 2 questions. Please make them quite short. And here. We'll just quite short, 2 minutes, please. Go ahead.
Me first?
Yes.
Okay.
Just 2 sentences, if you can, and then we'll take both of them at the same time, and then ask you to speak about them.
Thank you for inspiring 3 talks. They were all great. But it strikes me there's 2 models at the moment of economic development. One is free markets, free trade, tolerance, almost the London model of, a multicultural society with a great deal of tolerance, but also free trade, huge amounts of economic growth that threaten the environment, Trans-Pacific Partnership, things like this. On the other hand, there's the sort of Muncie, Indiana model of withdrawing and racial homogeneity, and maybe autarky, but more social solidarity, perhaps in groups. Now, I'm a progressive millennial. I favour the former, but I worry about the environmental consequences. What social and economic policies can we implement to avoid the negative social and environmental consequences of the former vision?
Okay. Go ahead. Yep.
Where are you?
Hi, over here. Thank you. Sorry.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to get your thoughts on the idea of attention as one possible virtue to cultivate. I guess you touched on it when you talked about the need to direct resources to the things that matter. And there's a whole raft of studies that say that a really big problem in society today is how we're losing our attention, so we're more distracted than ever. And of course, attention is an absolutely crucial prerequisite for care. And so for pro-social outcomes. And you read sometimes about the attention economy and it's some economic forces which are contributing to this sort of secular loss in attention. So I wondered what your thoughts are on attention as a topic.
Great, thank you very much. It won't surprise you on how we can solve these problems that I would refer again to the social democracies, especially of Northern Europe, because they come closest in the world to having the smart, fair, and sustainable approach. And indeed, all 3 of the Scandinavian countries have very clear roadmaps to 100% decarbonization. They also have the lowest inequality, and they're very prosperous. So that, to my mind, is important for us to understand. On the other hand, let me say there's a big complication, which is that while they're extremely generous and tolerant societies, the biggest aid givers in the world also, they face the same kind of anti-immigrant backlash that we see in other countries. Not quite as much, but you have the true Finns and you have the Swedish Democrats and you have the Norwegian People's Party and it's the same kind of thing. And what's interesting about all of those parties is they say, we like our social democracy. None of them is libertarian. None of them is what I would consider socially incompetent. But they say, we like it for us. This is our society. I think we need a serious discussion, which unfortunately we can't have right now, about migration, because what I believe to be true, but is hard to express in just a few words, is that neither side of the debate were nice and therefore were open, or we don't care and therefore we're closed, is accurate. And I believe that countries need borders, and I believe that migration needs to be managed, but it needs to be managed with a lot of conditions. One is that refugees need to be helped, for example, which is different from migration per se. That's international law and it's basic human decency. Second, having diversity in society is a strength, but completely open borders for rich countries, I think, is both unrealistic and destructive of social capital as well, because social capital emerges gradually over time, and there's a reality to it. And so I think that it's not so simple as saying the borders are wide open. I find that the left doesn't have a language for this right now. The language of the left is only we have to be decent, but it doesn't say what the limits are. And this, I think, is a big problem of politics right now, because I think the left can be decent, but not say we don't know what to do or we have no limits. And I don't see anything wrong with a country controlling its borders. Of course, it should be done with certain conditions, including a lot of generosity to make sure that people are living in decent conditions all over the world so that they're not desperately trying to come to one's country. So cutting aid, closing borders, and blowing up the environment is immoral. But limiting migration, giving extensive help, and controlling climate change, I think, is within the bounds of morality and good sense, by the way. But the left does not have that narrative, and it doesn't have the details, and this is one of the great weaknesses of politics right now. It's one of the reasons why the populist backlash is so strong, because the only argument against is we need to be generous, but not what are the limits. And anybody that understands the world economy should know if the door was wide open, a billion people would come in no time, and that would be highly disruptive of a lot of lives of people that don't have to disrupt their lives that way from a moral point of view. It's interesting, and I don't agree with it, and I know I shouldn't go on forever, but John Rawls, for example, took almost no interest in help for outsiders of the society. He said a society is an organic whole, and being behind the veil of ignorance is for your society. It's not for someone else. I don't agree with that. I'm globalist, but I do agree that there are limits that need to be recognized, and migration should be gradual. It should be controlled, but it should be moral and within a moral framework. And nobody has really worked that out well. I wrote a little bit about this in the American Economic Review Papers and Proceedings, May 2016, if you want to have a look at that. On the question of attention, what was that about? I can't agree more. The attention span is so short. It's unbelievable. I love being here, by the way, because BBC gives you more than 3 seconds to say something. I'm on TV in America a lot, and I can tell you, if I say one morning, by the way, the latest data shows the world is going to end by afternoon today, they will say, thank you very much. Now to the basketball scores. There is no capacity to actually have a conversation. You're desperate to get in your 3 seconds of sound bites. Then you check your Twitter. Then you know, it's craziness. These are complicated issues. They require attention. And we don't have that. And I am going to give a talk in Durham on Monday, actually, about what I call social consciousness. Not conscience, but consciousness. Because consciousness is part of our capacity to make rational decisions. And as a superorganism, as E.O. Wilson calls society, we also need a social consciousness. We need a social brain. that has an executive capacity, that has the ability to focus on something long enough to understand, we need a prefrontal cortex that has a time horizon of more than a tweet. And we don't have this right now. It's extremely dangerous. And it's also, I'm not saying anything original, but I'm coming more and more to understand how threatened we are. This is the week of fake news. And I didn't really appreciate it. I said something about climate change a couple of days ago in the United States in a TV interview. And I got the usual outpouring of hate mail. And when I get hate mail, I like to take one of them at random and write back politely and try to have a little sociological investigation. So I wrote back, thank you very much for calling me all those names. By the way, where did you get that fact which said something weird? And he said, wrote back, Mr. Sachs, it's on this website. And he sent me the link, and I clicked on the link, and it was a full website. And it was a full science story, and it was complete confabulation. And one of the reasons it was complete confabulation was the second line said by Dr. So-and-so at such-and-such institute in California, which I had never heard of. That didn't prove anything, but I Googled it, and it didn't exist. So I wrote back to him. I said, that's very nice, but I can't find the address for this institute. Could you let me know? And he wrote back. He said, are you calling me a liar? What about this? And then he sent me actually a NOAA website, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration website. And I wrote back and I said, sir, on the second line it shows not what you wrote, but that greenhouse gases are up 30%, not the 0.001. He wrote back to that saying, you don't understand anything. And then he wrote 10 new facts. And I thought, oh, God, I'm exhausted. I got to get out of the matrix. So I wrote back to him politely, always. And I said, thank you very much. Maybe it would be interesting for you to stop at a local college or university to talk to a scientist there. And he wrote back and right away, and he said, Mr. Sachs, I tried that. They're all like you. Okay, that was the end of the conversation. So this is really, it's really a complicated issue. The truth is, though, Americans, let me put the other side of it, because the deeper truth is that about 70% of Americans are kind of on the right side of this issue. They want to move to renewables. They don't want the fossil fuels anymore. They kind of understand it. They know the climate's changing. Yeah, probably human cause. It's not what I saw in that email. The real facts of America are not that kind of strange discussion, although you can see how it can persist. The real facts of America are the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil and Chevron. It's corruption. It's evil. It's greed. It's not the lack of attention. And, of course, it has been one of the highest aims of those companies to confuse the American public to the maximum extent possible. So at the end of the day, this really is political economy, even more than attention. Thank you very much.
I hope that all of us will take forward this challenge to develop and refine a language to speak about these moral challenges in a way that uses the science that we are learning and teaching here, but cultivates the kind of morality that we've talked about over the last three lectures. Thank you again, Professor Sachs, for joining us, for CEP, for the events team, for the Lionel Rectors.
Thanks to all of you.